Hello, welcome to Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On this week's podcast, in case of emergency, plant here.
We conserve them in seed banks, which is a fancy word for a freezer.
We look at how conservationists are making a backup copy of the Earth. Are high-speed trains the solution to Britain's transport and environment problems? Why babies are helping fuel climate change? Plus,
we do very often get people come up to us who, you know, failed science at GCSEs and hated it then. This is a chance where they can just see some really passionate and really personable speakers talk about fascinating things.
Our music festival is the right place to promote science. All that, plus why putting the words God and Stephen Hawking together in an article on the blog created a bit of a kerfuffle. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome everyone. We're going to get straight into things this week by talking about botany. Can the future of humanity be secured simply by saving seeds? Our survival depends on a thin layer of soil, plants, and the odd spot of rain. But pests, disease, and climate change all threaten that fragile balance. The Global Crop Diversity Trust is developing a system for conserving the biodiversity of all agricultural crops. We've been speaking to its executive director, Kerry Fowler.
If we want crops to be able to become more productive in the future because of expanding populations and increased demand for food, or we want them to adjust to climate change, for example, then we need the crops to adapt to those new conditions. And the raw material for adaptation is the diversity that you find within each individual crop. So you have to conserve it. There's no option.
So how do you go about conserving it? What do you do?
It's pretty simple. We conserve them in seed banks, which is a fancy word for a freezer. We basically dry the seeds to a fairly low moisture content, and we freeze them ideally around minus 18. And if we achieve that reliably, then these samples can last for many, many, many years. But the point is not simply to have them in the back somewhere and feel good about them existing. The point is really to have them available for use by plant breeders, because, you know, most people don't realize that the bread that they eat today is made from a different variety of wheat than 20 years ago.
With this kind of monoculture agricultural system that we've developed, are we putting ourselves at risk of a disease overwhelming the crops that we produce?
Well, there is a trade-off there, and the National Academy of Sciences in the United States many years ago identified the fact that genetic uniformity in our agricultural crops was giving us genetic vulnerability. In other words, if a pest or disease came into a field and found one plant to be tasty and vulnerable, then it found them all to be that. And so you had the possibility then that you could have a broad-scale crop failure. And indeed, we have some problems right now. We have a wheat rust that's striking wheat that's spreading out through the Near East, started in Africa. There's no real resistance in the field. So breeders are scrambling to try to find resistance among the old varieties in the seed banks and get that in to a modern variety and get it into the farmer's field before this new disease strikes.
I guess the other thing you mentioned earlier was climate change. I mean, how are seed breeders using the kind of seeds that you archive to make sure that plants are able to adapt to the changing climate?
The climate is changing quickly, and we know it's going to change in very dramatic ways just a few years down the road. Already we're seeing a lot more variability in temperature and rainfall and such. So plant breeders are going into the collections now looking for heat resistance and for drought tolerance and traits like that will give more resilience to the crops in the field.
The seed banks, where are they located?
Gosh, there are a lot of seed banks. There are over 1,000 around the world, but most of them are in really poor conditions. And so that's why we've been involved in setting up a seed bank near the North Pole inside a mountain there that would function as the safety backup for all the rest of the seed banks. So in other words, if a disaster strikes a particular seed bank in the UK or in Malawi or wherever, then that wouldn't equal extinction in the future, because we'd have that's the great thing about seeds, we can make a backup copy. So we'd have a backup copy inside this mountain in the North Pole.
Carrie Fowler there from the Global Crop Diversity Trust. He was speaking to Kevin Anderson of The Guardian at the TED Global event in Oxford recently. Remember, you can join our Facebook group or post a comment on the wall there, or leave some thoughts on our blog, guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. We've got Twitter too, that's twitter.com/scienceweekly. Let's take a look now at some of the other science stories around this week. This is the News Jam.
News Jam. An ultra-fast rail network's being planned for the UK. The government's hoping a 250-mile-an-hour network could replace the need for short-haul flights. It'd mean all major cities would be within 3 hours of London.
They may only have tiny feet, but a baby's carbon footprint has been calculated by statisticians in the States. Oregon State University says every child in the US adds 9,441 tons to each parent's carbon footprint. That's compared with 1,384 tons of carbon dioxide for each child in China, or just 56 tons in Bangladesh. The study is already proving controversial, with the Baltimore Reporter calling the authors reproduction Nazis.
The mystery over what triggers a gecko's stickiness may have been solved. Scientists have already worked out how they're able to hold on to just about any surface, but not what causes them to deploy the gripping mechanism. It appears the steepness of a surface rather than its slipperiness seems to activate the animal's incredible grip.
And finally, beekeeping is booming. Despite the humble bee dying out in recent years, apiarist courses are becoming oversubscribed in many areas of the UK, and membership of beekeeping associations is also shooting up. In response to the growing interest, a new plastic bee house has gone on sale, aimed at city dwellers. The giant cool box on legs promises 50 jars of honey a year. Thanks to producer Andy there for the News Jam. Now, we'd normally discuss these stories, but this week we're going to make you do some work. Why don't you go to guardian.co.uk/science and /environment for details on all those stories. And you can remember, you can comment on the blog. That's guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly.
Science Weekly.
Tents, scruffy, smelly people, mud, primitive latrines, and quantum physics. It's not what you'd expect at a music festival, but a group called Gorilla Science has been pitching both its canvas and a scientific message to revelers. We sent science writer Frank Swain to the Latitude Festival recently to see if he could manage to get any of the 15,000 odd festival goers interested in the Higgs boson.
I'm here in a field in Huntingdon, which for the next few days is home to the Secret Garden Party Festival. I'm surrounded by all the things you expect to see at a festival, tents selling vegan food, a drumming circle off to my right, and directly in front of me, a large group of people involved in some kind of hula hooping workshop. Looking past these, there's a pink stretched limousine sitting outside of another tent, and something you might not expect to see. A large crowd has gathered for a lecture on the neuroscience of music.
Shane Guevara hated music, couldn't dance, couldn't stand it. There's other theories that Ulysses S. Grant, American military leader during the Civil War, was in music, and also possibly Sigmund Freud, which I think would explain a lot.
My name is Zoe Cormier. I am one of the five gorilla scientists, the five people who put on this tent. The aim of the gorilla science tent is to basically challenge people's negative preconceptions about science, because unfortunately a lot of people have very incorrect and very disparaging opinions about science. They think that it robs life of its mystery and its beauty. They think of it as cold, as soulless studies of statistics, and they don't think, even if they sort of feel that it does have something worthwhile to teach us, that it's only useful insofar that it provides us with new information and tools for medicine and technology, and it doesn't teach us anything meaningful about what it means to be alive, and that it doesn't make life richer and more fascinating. And the fact is that science does. Science is just about exploring and celebrating what it means to be alive. And that's exactly what music festivals are for. So we feel this is a perfect forum in which we can put on talks and introduce people to fields of study that they may have not known existed and teach them new things and try and open up their world a little bit. And they don't have to mission to come find us. They don't have to go to a museum. We're just here in a field. They'll stumble upon us. And because, to be honest, they've been drinking and they've been relaxing, they are more open-minded and more willing to accept new ideas than maybe they would be otherwise.
And I've talked a bit about, you know, fruit and veg and things like that. Now I'd like to actually talk about illegal drugs, you know, because, and why I got interested in this was because people see this story about Equacy.
I'm John Butterworth. I'm a professor of physics at University College London, and I do a lot of research at CERN in Geneva. I've been to some pretty strange places. I've been to schools full of 5-year-olds and schools full of 18-year-olds and everywhere in between. But this is different than that.
Would you support more of this kind of putting science into weird places like this, this kind of action?
It's good. You've got real scientists doing it. So it's obviously not, you know, dumbed down. It's obviously real science. But it somehow manages not to be too preachy. And people are really into it here. And so I don't know how big the market for that is, but I think it's bigger than you've got here, and you should certainly do more of it. Yeah, I was very impressed.
I think it's wonderful. We were just saying now that you keep your brain working a little bit, and it's great.
I think we need more science in everything. I think scientific awareness is one of the most important things, and it's being really uninvested in this country.
You should be trying to learn things all the time, so it's great to have it at a festival. Wake up, learn something, go and get drunk afterwards.
I've seen stuff about landing on the moon, pigs, particles, what's inside a fly's eye for some reason.
And would you come to more lectures like this if they were in a festival?
Well, yes, maybe. I could say so if I wasn't that busy.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jar.
Before we wind up this show, let's look at some of the responses to a particular blog we had on the Science blog this week. It was the Guardian Science Book Club, which has been tackling Stephen Hawking's A Brief History of Time. Our literary guru, Tim Radford, kicked off proceedings and stirred up a hornet's nest by suggesting that one of the ingredients for the book's phenomenal success might be down to Hawking's boast that he was trying to understand the mind of God. Tim wrote, "The thing that really lit the blue touch paper, I now suspect, was all those references to God, and then you mentioned God, and this was what happens on the blog."
Commentator Sepia Tone was outraged by Tim's apparent implication that Hawking is a believer. As it was for Carl Sagan and Albert Einstein, said Sepia Tone, the word God for Hawking was merely a catch-all term for the sum of human ignorance, not the same God you go to church on a Sunday to worship and sing songs to. Sepia Tone argued the book's success had nothing to do with references to God, but rather that people were touched by the idea someone so physically challenged could influence great minds around the world.
Another commentator, Beeline32, thought that the book became a bestseller because it made the average man on the street feel a little bit smarter. On the same slightly cynical theme, commentator Archaic said it was down to people buying the book for their friends as a form of compliment. "Your friends won't read it," said Archaic, "but they'll think you regard them to be pretty intelligent." You can have your say on all of this stuff, of course, at the podcast blog. Go to guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. This month, the Science Book Club is reading Imagined Worlds, Freeman Dyson's extraordinary vision of the future. And in the second week of September, we'll be reviewing all the shortlisted titles for the Royal Society's coveted Science Book Prize and offering readers the chance to win all 6 books. Get all the details from guardian.co.uk/science. That's it for this week. Thanks to James Kingsland for helping us sort out this podcast, which was produced by Andy Duckworth. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening.